I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. What a joy it is today to welcome Makoto Fujimura as our guest on Conversing. Makoto Fujimura, also known as Mako Fujimura, is a leading contemporary artist whose process-driven, refractive, slow art has been described by David Brooks of the New York Times as, quote, a small rebellion against the quickening of time. Robert Kushner, in the mid-90s, reflecting on Fujimura's art in a book, Art in America, said this: "The idea of forging a new kind of art about hope, healing, redemption, refuge, while maintaining visual sophistication and intellectual integrity is a growing movement, one which finds Mako Fujimura's work at the vanguard." Mako, welcome to Conversing.
It's great to be here, Mark.
I should say for the sake of our listeners that you and I have known each other for maybe a dozen years or so. And I remember the very first time visiting you in what was then your studio in New York City and having the opportunity to talk to you about what the artist can teach the preacher about how to see the world. And it was a very, very important conversation to me personally. And the reflections that came out of that are ones that I have shared many, many times. But in addition to that, there's been since that time the growth of a friendship, which I just have to say means a great deal to me. And it was a particular joy and privilege to have you as part of Fuller for a number of years and for the work that you led in the Brehm Center for Theology, Worship, and the Arts. And for the particular work that you yourself led around culture care. These are all things that we're going to explain and say a bit more about. But thank you for sharing now, as we come to the conversation today, about your recent book, Art and Faith, A Theology of Making. It's really, really a remarkable book, Mako, and I am so eager to not only support it and encourage people to read it, but to have a chance today to explore it. So you're now back living most of the time, especially during these pandemic days, in Princeton, but you do have a studio still here in Pasadena that's just adjacent to Fuller's campus. So tell us about art in the pandemic season, for starters.
Well, first of all, the book, I think, came out of our conversation as well. Now that I think about it, way back when you visited me in New York, when you asked me about role of visual artists helping a preacher to see or understand scripture in a certain way. That was, I think, a beginning of many. What I sensed was happening was that preaching, especially in evangelical circles, have been devoid of input from poetry and imagination as well as visual arts. And so Dr. Ellen Davis and N.T. Wright and Miroslav Volf and others have began to write on these issues. But then I, as an artist, began to amplify, I think, in my own experience. So you're part of the journey, Mark, and I'm grateful for my time that I spent at Fuller, largely due to the fact that I could have these conversation partners with people at Brehm Center and beyond. And I mentioned some in my book, these conversations. So I'm indebted to being able to harness what I do today. I am in Princeton. I have been semi-sequestered here, which is actually a very happy thing, for an artist. I traveled quite often, as you know, and I'm thinking now I can't imagine doing that anymore because I'm so happy being in one place. And I think in my journey also personally has become very much attached to this place with my bride, Hedgen, dreaming of beauty and justice themes together. And so that's also a conversation that I think will, in the future, culture care will naturally extend into the work of justice and mercy. And so I have been here and I will most likely continue to expand my work here. And as I mentioned before the interview that I'm hoping to have a large exhibit in LA in the fall. So hopefully I'll get back to LA as well.
Yeah, we are eager for that to happen.
Well, I want to note from the top of this time together that we're recording this on inauguration day in the United States, January 20th. And I'm just exceptionally pleased for the convergence that on inauguration day, we would be having this conversation.
Yeah,
it wasn't, I think, so much a conscious plan as it was just a convergence of factors that made it happen. But that it has happened feels so incredibly fitting because of the issues that your book raises and the significance of the moment in American history that we're facing. When I invited you to come to Fuller, it was really because I was so clear in my own spirit that the work of theological education at a time when the church often seems barren, that it was really the arts that have to accompany our understanding of what it is that we're doing, not in some decorative sense, but in the generative sense of how art and artists create spaces for new ways of conceiving, enacting, hearing, attending, feeling, and creating in the world. And so that enterprise, which is certainly at the very core of who you are and what you've been about for many years, has been to me a particularly inspiring and encouraging prod in all of those ways. And this book feels to me like a magnum opus. That is, it feels like it gathers together the strands of your work and your reflection in such significant ways. So for those who haven't read the book, let's have you first just give an overview of what the book is attempting to say, and then I want us to zero in on certain parts.
Sure. Theology of Making, as it was titled originally, Yale added art and faith, probably the right decision, but it's my life work. It began literally with my childhood painting and sensing something flow through me that wasn't mine, but I felt connected in some way to my home, away from home. And I did not know what that place was until I began to understand the Bible. And as you know, I journeyed through literature, Milton and William Blake, to get to Jesus. And that happened in particular a time of my life where I was in Japan studying this ancient painting method of Nihonga. So it overlapped with my own way of re-examining my roots. I was born in Boston. My father, being a research scientist, we spent a lot of time in other places as well, such as Sweden. But I went to grade school in Kamakura, Japan, and then I was back in New Jersey for middle school, high school, went to Bucknell University in Pennsylvania. And that's where I encountered a lot of literature that relied on biblical understanding of the world. And I was enormously interested in, because I had that experience of sensing God's presence in my creative work and my studio, I did not have a language to explain that until I began to read the Bible and I began to see that this God of the Bible is the artist, you know, as I make a point in the book, perhaps the only artist who can create out of nothing. So this grand artist is inviting us little artists to participate in mending the brokenness all around us, but also to create into the new. And that journey is what I can offer to the readers as an artist, understanding the particularities of creative process and the role of what I call sanctified imagination that allows us to see God, to experience God, to taste God in tangible ways. And, you know, I think in general, Western education and how we convey information and truth has been truncated by the informational path only, forgetting that somatic knowledge is how we come into the world to touch, to feel, to even sense the aroma of the presence of the divine. It's not something that we talk about in churches, but I am particular in my role as an artist. I think that's perhaps the only way that I can learn to know something is by making. And so I talk about in the book the difference between, you know, let's say you have a recipe of an omelet and it doesn't matter how many times you memorize the recipe, until you make, you really don't know how to make an omelet. And so if that's true for an omelet, how is that true for theology? How is that true for every other form of knowledge? And I argue that unless we begin to understand biblical knowledge from the perspective of making, or any knowledge, actually. We can't say that we know it. So that's the summary.
You know, it's a common adage, I think, that people say that we don't know what we know until we can speak it or write it.
Yeah.
And that is its own practice of the point you've just made, right? Mm-hmm. Writing and speaking are their own versions of artistry, creativity, making. And it's directly tied in that little adage to knowledge, that we literally don't know what we think or feel or how or why we feel it necessarily until we have in some way made something of what is in us, mm-hmm. which is what the artistic process ultimately helps bring forth. It creates an occasion or an opportunity or a medium, however you want to describe it.
Yeah. So James' passage, you know, become a doer of the word.
Yes.
In the industrial translation, that's only the doing part, the activist yes. part. And yet the Greek there is poietes. So it literally means becoming a poet of the word, yes, which is a lot more than just doing. Poet pays attention to the nuance and the mystery of doing.
Right.
And so when we begin to see the Bible, and, you know, I spend a lot of time in the Fuller Library looking at the translations, because Septuagint Bible has over 3,200 times when this family of poietes, poema, is used. And it's always translated as do or work. Workmanship, you know, Ephesians translation, you are God's workmanship, that's poema. And yet it's kind of a industrial word that removes the poetic element. And so when you look at that passage alone, there's a huge difference between becoming a doer of the word and becoming a poet of the word.
It doesn't
exclude doing, by the way. If you're a poet, you have to execute, and you have to do, as Amanda Gorman today, the young poet laureate, so eloquently spoke, a 22-year-old spellbinding the world. And that gift captivates our imagination as much as it grounds the inauguration, you know, as it's not a fluff, it's not extra. It is the substance of the reality of the hope that we have, that America as a nation can become foot of this young, imaginative beings who are creating into the world. And so that's a fine way of doing democracy, right?
Yes, by creating, crafting.
Well, I think with people, as you say, in the United States and all around the world, Amanda Gorman's poem today was evocative and profound in a way that took the whole ceremony, which had its own substance and meaning already by that stage. There were many, many important things said and done that had created the moment. And then she stepped into the moment with her full voice, her being, her body, her social location, her education, and the sense of embracing and inviting creation forward and the creation of a nation, the creation of human expression and relationship, the creation and stimulus of imagination and hope.
Yeah.
I thought it was really quite a remarkable piece and will be commented on, I'm sure, for many, many years to come. Mm-hmm. I think that what it also does, and your work does this, Mako, as well as hers, is it's like an opened space into something previously unimagined. That's one way of describing art. There are many ways of describing it. But for me, great art has a way of somehow meeting us where we are, and then presenting an invitation, a welcome, that allows us to lean into all that it is offering us. And suddenly the world that might have seemed two-dimensional or three-dimensional just moments before suddenly breaks open like the black wall of a theater that collapses, and now you're suddenly seeing the whole world in a way that doesn't happen in the way that art does for many. Now, I think for other people whose gifts are mathematical, let's say, my brother-in-law is a theoretical mathematician and physicist, and I think he does experience mathematics in that way, that it suddenly breaks open and you have this rush of insight and understanding that is caused by this. And there's other manifestations of this, but I think it's just such an important thing, especially in this time that I'll just gather up many things and call again, like I did the church, barren. It's not barren of noise. It's not barren of activity. It's not barren of many, many things. Mm. But it feels like there's violence and division, but all around it feels barren. And the question is, as Amanda Gorman again was asking, where is light found? Mm-hmm. And art and theology of making helps move us in that direction.
Well, thank you. I do think that creative imagination, when we even use the word imagination, that has been exiled. You know, we say, well, you're imagining things, you know, connecting that to this frivolous fantasy rather than the hard work of a poet working and working until that, you know, list of alliterations work in a way that your sound, your voice can carry. And that is certainly one of the failures of the church, of the theology of 20th century, is that we have been so pragmatic about the nature of information of the gospel that we lost sight of sanctifying imagination as a key role of the gospel. When Jesus stood to give his Sermon on the Mount on the western side of Galilee, that was, if you can imagine, Amanda Gorman's spellbinding presentation multiplied Jesus speaking into people who are literally oppressed. They didn't know if tomorrow will happen. They had no security for their families. You think culture wars rhetoric is decimating. Back then, it was real wars that faced them every day and challenges. And yet Jesus's statement was to invoke abundance of creation, right? So consider the lilies around you popping up after the rain. Look at the birds of the air. And I stood there, Mark, and I realized as a bird watcher that this is the largest migratory path of the world. That is the Jordan Basin is where the millions of birds fly from Mozambique to Europe and back. And Jesus speaking in the season that he would bring the masses out to the hills would have been pointing at the sky that is darkened with birds and saying, you know, look at the birds of the air. Literally calling into the abundance of God's creation in a scarcity-filled land, the most contested land in that area. And then invoking the new creation, saying that I am here to usher in a new wineskin, new paradigm, and you are to take my message and to take my sacrifice and to bring in, usher in this new creation. So that's an artist's work, is to stand in the midst of ground zero or scarcity-ridden world and say, but look at these possibilities, and you see that in I Have a Dream speech. You see that in anything that moves the needle of culture. There is something about poets' ways, a preacher's ways, an artist's way to open the new, not in the sense of, you know, a new iPhone, but what I call new newness of the Greek word kainos, that in Christ we are new creation.
This is all tied to one of the words that you use that I think is so helpful to people, and I'd like to have you just say a bit about it. And that is the idea of artists as border stalkers.
Yes.
Talk about that, the image, and why it is that that is a word that can describe this significant contribution.
Yeah, so I began to write about this, my conversation with Bruce Herrmann, who is an artist and a friend that we journeyed into T.S. Eliot's poem Four Quartets together, and we did a collaborative exhibit, concert, and so forth. And he mentions Beowulf and how J.R. Tolkien translated Grendel as Meastapa, which is border stalker in Old English. And it's a wonderful word, Meastapa, you know, it's literally stalking borders. And he said, we artists are like these border stalkers that seem to be drawn outside of the tribal zones intentionally in order to discover nourishment or new ways of navigating the tribal conflicts. So we tend to be good at moving into another tribe and blending in and understanding the culture and language. I write this in my culture care book, but Strider of the Bree in Lord of the Rings.
Right.
Húdin is in the corner and the bar owner says, you know, that man is dangerous, you know, stay away. Turns out to be Aragorn, the king, but it took Gandalf to see that and to actualize that potential in Strider to become Aragorn, border stalker who understand Elvish ways and culture,
right.
Even married
right.
A daughter, Elvin. So he represents, and by becoming a king, he reunites divided tribes.
Yes.
And that is precisely what I think artists can do if we can harness that energy, creative energy, as well as leadership that comes from observation skills and learning the new language and new culture, adaptability that artists often have. And
yes.
They can lead, they can really help the church. And by the way, Jesus was a Meastapa. You know, he
right.
intentionally took his disciples outside of their tribal comfort zones,
right,
to show what it means to love the enemy. Then the drama is taking place in the New Testament. Oftentimes, disciples taken out of the context of their normative structures, comfort zones, and they're literally face to face with the margins of society. And so the shepherd, the poimen, shepherd is taking the sheep outside to explore the borderlands, which is dangerous, which he says one may get lost and I'm going to leave the 99 behind and save that sheep, which is me. But I know that as an artist, I know both potential and the danger as well.
You know, I'm struck by that text in Matthew 8, when just shortly after the Sermon on the Mount, he comes down and he encounters a person with leprosy.
Yeah.
But then the next encounter is with a Roman centurion who asks him to come and heal one of his men. And in that context, Jesus says, I'll do it. And the man says, no, you don't need to do it. You just say the word. And then what Jesus does is such a great example of what you were just saying. He slows down the action. He stops it, actually, and then says to everyone, did you hear what he just said?
Yes.
I have not heard faith like this from a Roman centurion representing the domination of Roman authority and power. I have not heard faith like all of this in all of Israel.
Yeah.
It's dangerous.
Yes.
It's full of vision.
Yes.
It's full of a very acute attention about what the man is really saying and out of what reservoir of faith he's actually bearing witness, right?
Yeah.
But it's wrapped in a completely unexpected and unacceptable form, really.
Right. Transgressive in a sense, too.
Yes.
Woman at the well, you know, same thing. And so there are many examples of Jesus doing this, almost setting himself up before the disciples. So they're so shocked, they can't forget that, you know, what happened. So they later on, they're like, oh, remember that time when Jesus did this?
Yes.
And we're like completely confused, you know?
Yes.
Well, he's actually cracking open the universe.
Right.
It's just the most amazing.
Yeah.
Marco, I want to have you explain one other term that you use and the way that you use it and why. And then I want to come to a specific chapter in your book. And that's really this phrase that I think you have created for quite deliberate reasons and have been using now for quite a number of years of culture care.
Yeah.
So tell us what that means, how border stalkers relate to culture care, and then we'll come to this chapter that I want us to ask
about. Yeah, so, you know, even starting in New York City in the late 90s, and I became part of the National Endowment's effort to advocate for U.S. arts in early 2000 under President Bush, working with then the chair, Dana Gioia, amazing Catholic poet and a businessman who literally quelled the culture wars at the time in D.C. I watched him do it, and I was speaking to my editor what he does just on day-to-day basis, turning conservative senators who wanted to abolish the NEA into a jazz advocate, or, you know, being part of a Shakespeare reading, and somehow their hearts changed. And I said, well, it's culture care, you know, instead of culture wars. And as I later said, that it's a nonviolent resistance to culture wars. And then, you know, things became kind of serious because I realized that culture wars rhetoric would lead to real wars. And what we witnessed on the epiphany of this year was a direct result of culture wars rhetoric. That's what happens. And you could see it coming. People from other countries warned us that that's what happens in their country, is that culture war rhetoric will literally become wars. And in a sense, citizens will suffer because of it. And so I felt there was something to this. It was not just me advocating for the arts. It had something fundamental with human dignity and society that needs to speak and understand the other rather than demonizing the other, but to understand. But how do you talk about that as an artist? And I began to understand this from the perspective of defending modern dancers and poets from getting eliminated from education and getting exiled. And of course, as a Christian, I saw this happening in the churches. And so I really wondered, what is the proper way? So I wrote Culture Care as a series of lectures. But each lecture that I gave in the public sphere had an undergirding theology behind it, which I'm not going to talk about because you can't assume that everybody's Christian or understand biblical theology. So I kept on writing these pages and pages of basically what turned into my book, Theology of Making, which is, by the way, only one third of what I had written. And my editor did a fine job of just narrowing it down so can be read. But I have many, many other thoughts about this that takes biblical passages and exegetes that into what I call theology of new creation, rather than stopping at the redemptive place, which is central, obviously, that's at the heart of the gospel. And yet oftentimes you stop at Jesus being resurrected and there you go. You know, you have to take this and bring it to your neighbor, which is not wrong. It's just not fully realized. Because the whole thing is that when Jesus ascended, it's the new creation beginning on this side of eternity. It's a, you know, inauguration of the new creation. And as N.T. Wright has been writing about in the resurrection theology, that we have truncated the gospel as this information-driven way of convincing our neighbors that you believe this and you go to heaven, when really this is a new way of living into the kingdom that is advancing. And furthermore, God actually waits until we Christians activate in faith something that is to be a deposit of the new creation into what is now in our fractured earth, that we are to somehow by faith stand on our ground zeros of the world in the fractures. And with faith, we are to create into that. By doing that, God is going to usher in the new creation. God chooses to wait until we we actually do this. And that message is not really heard. And so we end up being a very much what I call plumbing theology, where we fix the world. For what purpose? We don't know. But we're going to fix the world because our neighbors, we don't want them to go to hell. So we provide them with the right tools to fix the pipes and so forth. But really what's happening is when we fix the pipes, the new wine floods into and the old wineskin is going to break. And so the church should be preparing people to create the new wineskin rather than defending the old wineskin. Because once the pipes do what they're supposed to do, you will be flooded with this new wine full of life. And so old models will not be able to handle. And I feel like the church in fighting the culture wars is trying to simply patch up the old wineskin. And because we are afraid of institution as we know it, the mega churches and the mechanism of our churches will fall apart. It is falling apart. So what is the new wineskin? How do we get there? And so that part, I don't talk about in my culture care book, but I write about in my new book, Theology of Making.
I'm Mark Laberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. So let me just gather up a few terms and then ask you a few questions about this one chapter in the book. So we begin with the God of creation and creativity, who has fashioned a world that's found itself in brokenness and pain and suffering.
Yeah.
The vocation of becoming human is a vocation of making, in which we come into ourselves by learning to make and by God's grace, hopefully discover that the God who made us is the God who actually gave us these capacities and wants us to do even more making.
Yes.
We need people that can help us see that. They come in many different forms. Some might be called border stalkers, who as artists have this capacity to help us see what might even be very close at hand, but otherwise just inaccessible.
Yeah.
And then we come to be able to understand that this is actually not just a private effort, it's a collective effort that has to generate a whole canon and should generate a new kind of making in which literally we participate with God and with one another in this work of recreation. Mm-hmm. Now, in the midst of that, we would say, but, you know, there's really a problem. It's called, in classic theological terms, it's called sin, or it's called just human brokenness. It's called, like, we've got a problem. And this is what brings us to this particular chapter that I want to commend to everyone. The whole book you need to read, But there is one chapter which focuses in on something called kintsugi.
Yeah.
And kintsugi is something Michael will just explain in a moment. But really, in a certain way, kintsugi is a way of taking a theology of making and saying, but what does it look like in a culture that's actually just broken?
Yeah. I have here an 18th century tea bowl, and kintsugi flowed out of aesthetics and a tea ceremony liturgy of Senno Rikyu, who created this form of peacemaking in time of feudal wars and created an aesthetic that influenced the entire Japanese culture. But he would introduce a bowl like this, a black bowl, which is Korean in origin. And there's a famous story of him having his ceramicist, who was Korean, enslaved really in Japan, making roof tiles, create a black tea bowl, which was not something that people wanted to have tea. And they wanted this high porcelain, white ceramic Chinese porcelain, which was considered to be elite. And as you can see, this bowl is not perfect, but intentionally imperfect. And then when this bowl broke sometime, you know, maybe through an earthquake, the families of tea masters will often hold on to the fractured bowls for several generations. And then they will give it to a Japan lacquer master who would mend it. But they will not mend it perfectly back, but they will mend it with gold, highlighting the fractures, then actually creating a new design using the fractures. So the resulting bowl is more valuable than the original because there are, you know, two or three masters who worked on this, generational and, you know, passed down. So this art form of kintsugi is just so profound. And as I write in my previous book, Silence and Beauty, it's connected with Japanese sense of understanding. I believe there's a hidden gospel here in kintsugi. And so I have a chapter in my new book on kintsugi as an example of theology of new creation, because we remember that Jesus, in post-resurrection appearances, has the nail marks. That's why Thomas is invited to touch them, right? And he doesn't, by the way. This is a very important thing for me. He does not. He doesn't need to. He worships. And so Jesus's post-resurrection body has the nail marks, which means that the fractures and the trauma is carried into the new creation and made new. And it's through his wounds we are healed. So there's literally light flowing through Jesus' wounds from the new creation into this dimension. Mm-hmm. And just as kintsugi, the gold lines through the cracks, the light can flow through. And so, as you know, you participated in one of our early Kintsugi Academy workshops.
Yes.
I've been working with a Kintsugi master who developed a new way of doing Kintsugi, doing it authentically, but in a way that's accessible to people, because it was after 2011 disaster, Tohoku, great earthquake and tsunami, that he felt as a kintsugi master, he needed to bring kintsugi into the affected areas somehow. And Japan lacquer is notoriously difficult. It is a kind of a secret tradition that uses poison sumac. So, you know, 1/3 of the population is allergic to this. There's no way you can just carry this, because it would take a year sometimes for it to dry in the moisture of Japan. Intentionally, it has to dry in the moisture, but it takes a long time. So he came up with this new method, working with a fishing rod company, of creating new urushi, new Japan lacquer made on cashew nuts, which dries in about 3 hours. And it's suspended in liquid, so even if you're allergic to nuts, we find that it's okay. So we created this kit, a Kintsugi Academy kit, that anybody can practice Kintsugi, get inside of this tradition, be introduced to it. So I've been practicing this myself. I have a little Kintsugi table here, and as I work in my studio, I have been learning this method, traditional venerable method. And what happens is, and I would love to hear your experience, but when we actually slow down and start to mend, something happens to our brain. I think it starts to rewire. And there was a trauma counselor who came to one of our early workshops, and she said, you know, first 6 months with my clients, all I can do is to convince them that you cannot run away from your trauma, that it doesn't go away. And they have to realize that the fracture is always going to be there. but it's how you deal with that. That is the therapy. And she said, doing kintsugi for 3 hours, she said, literally, this is what she needs to do with every client, because that teaches you that fracture is something to honor rather than to reject and run away from. You know, naming the fractures, beholding the fractures. If we can do that, then our hands will start to mend, just naturally mend. And it's like, you know, the putty is like Play-Doh. So you're forming this putty to fill in the cracks. And all of a sudden, your brain is opening up rather than closing. And ostensibly, what happens in the workshop is that people began to share why they brought the pieces that they have brought, or why they have been going through some sort of trauma. And these are total strangers. And I've done this on Zoom, and same thing happens. And so something must trigger our brain when you're making, releases it from our lockdown positions and our defensive positions, and opens up this path of healing. And so this is more than just doing kintsugi. It seems like it's a path to a communal practice of culture care.
It's like an experience of communal meditation.
Yeah.
While you're actually doing something. So instead of just, as it were, sitting there in a circle,
yeah,
in silence, for example, which is its own way of doing something important. But in this case, you may be at a table, as I was at the workshop of yours that I attended, and I was given the pieces of a small bowl. And over the course of time, it was this experience of getting really acquainted with all of the crack lines and with all the nuances of how they needed to be prepared, in part to be able to be reattached, then how it is that every crack line and nuance was much more fine and different than another crack line in the same bowl. And the processes of doing that, the holding of it, the feeling of the clay, the feeling of the putty, and then eventually after that and sanding and various things, then being able to apply these very fine gold lines that then took really what had been just a very small little teacup sized piece of pottery, but made it really quite lovely. And it sits next to the sink that I use every morning when I'm getting ready for the day. And it has often been a focus of meditation about what is the brokenness that I'm taking into the day? What are the places in my own life or in the institution that I'm leading or in the world that I see around me where there are these broken lines? But it is very calming. By the end of that little session, which I suppose was, what was it, maybe 2.5 hours or something, not very long, I found myself really in a very different kind of meditative state where I felt like I wanted to now look at the world along kintsugi lines and ask, what would it be like if that fissure line that I might be seeing or particularly feeling on any given day could ever come to be attached and healed? Mm-hmm. And in the best sense, sort of, it's not exactly validated, but that's part of it. It is genuinely beautifying it. A place that was a scar becomes a place of visual attraction.
Yes.
And so forth. Now, in your book, what's wonderful about it is the way that you use this and other things that we've talked about today as examples of how an artist's way of seeing enables us to not only perceive differently, but then to act differently in response to what we're seeing. And kintsugi brings this together. And it can happen on the micro level.
Yes.
It can happen on the interpersonal level, et cetera, right? It's fully scalable. It could be international and global, which is what we need to be doing in response to the global crisis that we're facing of the environment.
Yes.
But it also can come down to very particular personal actions taken in a micro space, right?
Yeah.
And with no skill. I had never done this before. I knew nothing about it except the idea of it.
Yeah. And I think one of the most profound things actually is in preparing for kintsugi workshop, right? You ask people to bring in something that's broken. And
yeah, right.
In America, the typical answer is, well, I don't have anything because I just throw out, right? And kind of in the beginning of doing workshop, I kind of accepted that as an answer, you know, so you say, oh, it's okay, you know, you can come and we'll prepare something for you. But then I realized, Mark, that the more I get sensitized to doing kintsugi, the more I see brokenness. Like in a couple that I thought was perfect ceramics, you know, coffee mugs. Now I'm able to actually discern like which one has hairline fractures by the way the sound of the coffee hitting the cup. And I could never have that kind of knowledge.
Yes, yes.
Until I began to see, and then the world, as you noted, looks different because now you're highly sensitized, your somatic, you know, your hands and your brain are connected in some way. So when you're speaking to somebody who has experienced trauma or, you know, is going through something, the whole reaction that you have, and I keep remembering Master Nakamura, the Kintsugi Master, who kept on saying, you know, we're not here to fix. We are actually going to name first the fractures and behold it. And that may be enough, you know, even not using the kit. Just looking at it. And if your mind can go from there's something wrong with this to, oh, this is beautiful. This is a valley. This is a river. And that in personal relationships, it has a profound impact. Because typical of, as you and I have gone through suffering, we know like Job's friends who come with, you know, all the right way to fix you is not very helpful, you know.
Right.
And the way we can move forward in trauma and suffering and fragmentation, polarization and divisiveness and all that that we're experiencing and sickness is not to say, you know, of course we need a vaccination, you know, that's a good way. But even with that, right, we're not going to be fixed in a way that we think normality is going to come back. And that's an illusion that we have to deal with. And there's going to be trauma. After 2020, everybody is going to be a survivor. There's going to be survivors' mindset and psyche and things that we will experience. I'm a 9/11 survivor. And I'm still discovering hairline fractures in my life. That's going to happen to all of us. So how are we going to navigate the future full of hairline fractures that we can't even see? And I think, again, if you can learn to rewire your brain to see the fractures and say, this is an opportunity to sit with it, to meditate, to behold. And then maybe some traumas we can't fix at all. Like the Kintsugi family holding on to the fragments for several generations is absolutely genius because some trauma you cannot fix. It takes several generations to behold the fractures, tell that story. And then at some point, it can be mended to be made new.
Today is Inauguration Day, and as a result, this image, I think, plays in my own spirit and mind in a very, very powerful way, because we know as a nation, as a church in America right now, as an evangelical church in America right now, as simply citizens of a complicated nation, that there are fracture lines everywhere. Some are vast, and some are more hairline fractures. But what I love about this image, Marco, and the participation that we all are invited to bring to it, is that we don't have to wait around for an exceptional artistic heart, mind, and talent like yours to come along and create something or make something for us. It's meant to be work that we all do.
Yes.
And your work or the work of other exceptional artists minister and inspire us and whet our appetite for this.
Yeah.
But all of us in our ordinary places can actually engage in Kintsugi work.
Yes.
And it is about naming, seeing, beholding the fracture lines, not avoiding that. It is about the clay and the mud, as it were, that needs to be put in to help the healing. Eventually, it could be the gold line that gets applied. But clearly, just to brutalize the analogy a bit, you don't start with the gold line and work backwards. You have to do the healing work all along the way. Yeah. And I do think that the courage begins right at the start, doesn't it, of actually being willing to look at the brokenness. I think a lot of American culture is about throwaway brokenness as opposed to beholding brokenness. And that has to be recovered as a cultural value. That's part of culture making.
Yeah. And we have indigenous cultures, we have African American cultures, we have blues, you know, we have jazz. And these are examples. Dancers know this real well because their bodies are never perfectly healthy. They're always dealing with injury. But, you know, a good choreographer knows that and brings out what a dancer can do. And so this is part of our journey into the brokenness, is that artists can take the lead in this because we are broken, first of all, and we're obviously so. But at the same time, if we understand when something drops, right, and breaks, I'm excited. you know, because I'm like, oh yes, you know, I can do kintsugi now, you know, how would I do that with this piece, you know? And that kind of response is, you know, what happens to me.
That's great.
I am actually excited that America has visible fissures, that it was hidden before, but it's now out in the open. I'm actually excited that we can look at the fractures and behold them and listen to the cries that are coming out of these fractures. And I'm excited that we can, in this inauguration day, it doesn't matter who the president is, we have stored away all the traumas of the past and have been running away from them. And, you know, I'm excited that we at least know now the consequence of culture wars. Fighting with a rhetoric to demonize the other side. And Absolutely. Our children are telling us that's not what we want. We want to think about the environment in a new way as a stewardship issue. We want to know if there is a way that we can be different but together. Those are things that, to me, are opportunities that because we have gone through 2020, the slowing down, the fragmentation, we now can see, as a kintsugi master sees the world. And that, to me, is a gift as hard and painful as that is to go through.
And as you and I both know, that kintsugi work needs to happen in the church
yes.
toward its own life,
yes.
as well as then becoming potentially an inspiration and a partnership with kintsugi work that goes on in our culture.
Exactly.
That's a double combination. It's not just for, quote, them. It's actually for me and for us, whoever the us might be. And how this is a manifestation in its own right of the gospel, if we understand it in the way that you're describing it. I just think it's an extremely poignant thing to me that on this inaugural day that we would have been able to have this conversation.
Yeah, and what would happen to the church or seminary that sees brokenness in a way that kintsugi master will see brokenness? What would happen if we had a community that somebody comes in with brokenness and that person starts to share that and everybody says, we're excited that you're here because, right. like you said, your fractures are so unique and it's beautiful. We're not here to fix you. We're here to journey together, behold you, and mend eventually to make new. But God is going to do that. All we're going to do is to journey together. That would change the world. And the church can become once again a harbinger of hope in a broken time where the witness of thousands of Christians during the Black Plague has created a kind of a church that we have inherited. But we can be that again. And we can be leaders in not afraid to show our vulnerability, our weakness, our brokenness. Even if the church is fragmented, we have so many young people who have left the church. But they can lead in this, because they know instinctively that this kintsugi path is the right way. And so I think kintsugi generation is already birthed. It was in the young poet's voice today.
Yes,
and
it was.
I was so moved by it.
Marco, thank you so much for this. I do want to say to the people who are listening to this conversation that some of you would naturally find a book called Art and Faith to be something that you would go for because you may be artists or you may just be curious or you may find that that language and vocabulary has always been important to you. But what I want to say about this book is that it may not be you that needs this book as much as the people who perhaps listening to this might think, oh, that's not my kind of book, who would be amazed, honestly, if you give this a fair reading at its timely and powerful relevance to your life and to the world that we're living in right now and to the church. So, Marco, thank you again for this conversation.
Thank you, Mark.
You have been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.